Haunt Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Ever had an experience where you've been traveling in a foreign country and you hear a familiar voice, turn around and see someone you know from home? Our guest today had a similar experience, except it was his brother who had the familiar voice, and neither of them had known the other was on the road. Everybody has a story to share about a bizarre or amazing coincidence, but what does the math tell us about how unbelievable these seemingly random occurrences actually are? I'm joined now by Joseph Mazur, author of Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence. He's also professor emeritus of mathematics at Marlborough College, and he's going to talk through some pretty funny, poignant, and cool stories. We're also hearing a ton of them already from you, our listeners. See what I said? Everybody has a story. And we're going to examine the math behind them. Professor Mazur, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Jane, for having me on your wonderful show.
Oh, well, thank you for being here. And I guess you have to tell us this story of how you and your brother happened to find each other in a foreign country.
Well, it is somewhat of a typical story of meeting people you know in very foreign places. I was on a Greek island. It was many, many years ago when I was traveling on a Greek island. And I was in a very, very tiny, small village at a taverna and sitting and having a coffee. And I heard in a distance, quite a distance, a laugh that I knew was quite familiar. And I turned around and looked, and I saw my own brother with other people and other people I knew as well.
So does that say more about your family closeness, perhaps, than the amazement of the coincidence?
It says that it's a wonderful story. That's really what it says. And, you know, we're blessed with all these wonderful stories. And, you know, the whole history of the world is a great story. And I feel that many of these stories are just wonderful to hear, especially the coincidence stories.
Is that really the impetus then behind this book? As a mathematician, are you just looking for an excuse to get some of these stories out there?
No. Well, it all started at a residency in Italy. I was with a number of guests at a compound in Italy. And I at breakfast each morning, somebody would come down and say, "I have a wonderful coincidence to tell you." And I would analyze the coincidence as a mathematician and say, "Well, you know, it is a coincidence, but it here's the likelihood of it happening." And the next morning, the same person would come down again with another coincidence story. And this would repeat over and over again until one day she said, "You know, you should write a book about coincidences." That's where it all began.
And there it began.
I said, "I don't want to write a book about coincidences. I know nothing about coincidences." But it turns out that I now do.
Yes, and I hear you now get stories from everybody in the world who hears that you've written a book about
coincidences. Once people know that you're writing a book on coincidences, you hear them all the time.
Well, we want to hear more of them today. So listeners, please continue to share. As I said, we've been getting a ton of them. You can find other people's stories on the Vermont Edition Facebook page where you can add your own. Or you can go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition and add your story there. Or you can give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We're going to share some of these stories, and then I hope Professor Mazur won't ruin the amazement we have by talking
about... I'll try not to.
By talking about how likely these stories actually are. I'll read you a few. Colleen just posted on Facebook, "Just this morning I was thinking about a time when my pal Eric approached me on the street in Johnson, Vermont, wearing a shirt I had made in high school 5 years prior to that. I'd given the shirt to a Salvation Army in Hartford, Connecticut, and I hadn't seen the shirt or thought of it in years until Eric came walking down the street wearing it, 5 years later and two states away. I thought about that this morning, and then on my way to work, I heard this would be today's subject." Cool stuff.
Double coincidence.
You have in your book. You have some double and triple coincidences.
Triple coincidences, yes.
We got a note from Marnie who says, "I have experienced many instances of being somewhere and having my path unexpectedly cross with someone I know, so much so that my friends have come to expect this to occur whenever I travel. The most unusual and amazing experience was in Moscow on an April night in 1990, when the country was still the Soviet Union. I was traveling with a group from Vermont known as the Children's Art Exchange. I had attended Easter evening service at a Russian Orthodox church, It was expected to be a crowded situation, and our Russian guide made sure to tell us exactly where the tour bus would pick us up after the service, knowing we'd probably get separated. I was standing at the prescribed spot waiting for others in the group to make their way, and as I stood in the darkness, the woman next to me at the curb, not part of our group, began to turn toward me. I don't speak Russian, and as she turned, I worried I'd have a struggle to even help her understand my limitations. I was completely surprised when she said, "I don't know your name, but I know you live in Middlebury, Vermont." As I looked at her, I responded immediately with, "I don't know your name, but I know you live in Middlebury, Vermont." We began a wonderful conversation immediately. She was with a group of students from the college. Several years ago, I was relating this incident to a new friend while sitting by the Otter Creek in Middlebury. Just as I finished relating this amazing situation of years past, the same woman walked up with a small group of friends, and we laughed once again about the timing. So there again.
Another double coincidence.
And
these are wonderful.
Is really. That rare, or do people often
have
those? Well,
we now learn that we are blessed with the number of coincidences, a number of acquaintances and friends that we do have. That's the beauty of it. The wonderful thing is that we ignore the vastness of our friendships, and we also ignore the vastness of the world. We have no conception of how big the world is and also how small the world is when we include our friends. In other words, the groups that we know and are part of. So, I mean, for example, you know, the world is unimaginably and frighteningly vast. Just to give some impression of just how vast it is, let's count the seconds to three. One, two, three. Now take a guess. The reader, the listeners should take a guess at how many barcode scans worldwide passed in those 3 seconds.
Whoa, I have no idea.
Would you like to take a guess, Jane?
A million.
That's a pretty good guess, but it's pretty high. I was hoping
really?
You were going to say 10,000.
I thought
but
commerce,
this is
you
3 seconds, just 3 seconds. It's about 200,000.
Oh,
but
wow.
That still is, you know, if you were to ask me before I researched this topic, I would say, 10,000, maybe 50,000.
I'm just thinking of how fast the cashiers are at the grocery store. They could scan a lot of items in 3 seconds.
That's right. Worldwide, it's about 200,000,
wow.
According to Nielsen estimates. Huh. By the time we count to 40, you know, somebody in the world will have committed suicide. I don't want to bring in that kind of dark side to it. But we have to understand how big the world really is. And we usually have our own impressions are that it's much smaller than it actually is. So we bring it down to our comfort level by telling and hearing coincidence stories that make the world shrink. And we crave that comfort. It's also a reason, in my opinion, why we love stories in general.
But doesn't it seem like that vastness would increase the amazement that you could ever run into somebody you know in a strange place or have these coincidences?
It's vast, but for us, you know, our enclave, our neighborhood, and I'm using neighborhood in a metaphorical sense, our neighborhood is much bigger than we really think it is. So that when we take a vacation, we want to go someplace, well, we are friends. And our acquaintances are likely, fairly likely, to be going or thinking about going to roughly the same places. When, you know, most people are not going to the outskirts of, you know, people I know anyhow don't seem to be, I don't know, I shouldn't say where they would go. But I would say that they are going to the places we would normally go to, too.
We got another note from Dave in Middlebury who says, is it possible that some people experience more fluky coincidences than others? I often feel like I've had more of them than normal, and I feel like Vermonters in general have more of them than normal.
I think it's because Dave is noticing them more than other people. A lot of it has to do with the noticing. You notice if you're very aware of things and you process things in terms of notifying yourself about these things, you're more aware that something is going to happen and something will happen. I mean, it comes down to the whole question of what Jung once called synchronicity. That is, it's all in the noticing, but there's something in the mind that's already there that's waiting for the next thing to happen, and you're going to be noticing it more.
All right, one more comment here, and then I want to get into some of these probabilities and what you've been looking at, Professor Mazur. Gary in Richmond says, 28 years ago, I was going to UVM and taking a night class in the Living and Learning Center. After class, I was waiting for a truck to pass at the Main Street crosswalk to get to my vehicle to drive home. I was hungry and deciding whether or not to drive to Al's French Fries to get a cup of fries. Usually, there were many people in vehicles at this time of night, but at this moment, there was only me and the unmarked truck. Just as the box truck was in front of me, it hit a frost heave and the back door slid up and a box slid out onto the road. Then the door slid back down and closed. The driver didn't notice and continued on. I went over to the box and, of course, it contained 6 5-pound bags of frozen French fries.
That's wonderful. See, that's just a wonderful story. Yeah, and if that isn't synchronicity, I don't know what is.
We are talking today about coincidence and what mathematics tells us about the probability and possibility of these strange things that happen to us. We have more of your stories to share. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Professor Mazur, can you tell us what the difference is between a fluke, serendipity, and coincidence?
Yes. A coincidence for me is an event where two events actually colliding in metaphorical space and time, where the cause of that collision is not apparent, and also that has to have some kind of a surprise. So that's what a coincidence is. Now, once you say that, you have to realize that I use the word non-apparent, which is a kind of a vague word in some sense because it's relative to the person who it's addressed to. That is it non-apparent to everybody or is it non-apparent to the person who is experiencing the coincidence? So there's a kind of a rough spot there. Everything has a cause, unless you're talking about, let's say, quantum physics. But everything would have a cause if you're not talking about anything like Jung's synchronicity. But with the cause, if the cause is discovered, then the coincidence demotes itself to a fluke. In other words, the fluke is there is a cause, and the cause is a little bit more obvious, and you can pick out the cause pretty clearly. In a fluke, that is, once you analyze it.
Hmm.
Once you get to serendipity, well, that's luck, really, and it's a matter of mostly good luck. In other words, serendipitous things are usually lucky things that are in a good way lucky.
Hmm. Since we're talking about definitions here, I'm going to read us one more here from Andrea, who says, on a local citizen website, the moderator posts old articles from the 1800s local paper and had posted a word game from one of those editions. Long story short, the word solution was honorific abilitudinity. Included in the game were several other old words, and I was bemoaning that the Oxford English Dictionary online subscription rate was so high that I couldn't afford it because I wanted to check some of the words, including, of course, this word of honor, so to speak. Well, at the exact moment I was posting my bemoaning, my email notification scrolled across the top of my screen saying my word of the day from the OED was being delivered, and that word, incredibly, was honorific abilitudinity. What are the chances that the moderator would have posted this word game that he randomly found in an old 1800s newspaper from Brattleboro, decided to post that particular one that day, that it would be the OED's word for the day, that my bemoaning the OED would occur at the exact moment my word for the day notice came in from the OED?
I hope that the caller has posted this because I'd really like to see this and analyze this. I would be happy to figure out something that would give us a sense of the odds of that happening.
Oh, it's so pretty... do you want Andrea to get in touch with you? She posted it on
Well, if
Facebook
she posted
page.
Post it on your website, then I'll get it
Good.
As well.
That would be great. It's on the Vermont Edition Facebook
But,
page.
You know, I have another one very similar to that. It's somewhat similar, and I wrote about it in the book a little bit. I was vacuuming my little cottage in Vermont, and the vacuum cleaner got too close to my dictionary. At least a 1,200-page dictionary. And it got too close to the dictionary, and it sucked in one page.
And because you leave the dictionary open.
I leave the dictionary open at the spine because I don't want to break the spine. It's a big dictionary, so I leave it open at the spine. So a few minutes, not too much time, went by. Now, this is actually a true story. That I was the only one there, so I have no
we
backup.
We just have to take your word for
it. Yeah, you'll
it.
Have to take my word for it. So it turned out that just moments later, it might have been a half an hour later, let's say, I realized that I had to look up the actual definition of synchronicity. And you can guess what page that synchronicity was on.
Yeah, so now you have no idea what the word
means. I had
means.
No idea from that dictionary. That's true.
Let's go to Jim calling in from East Randolph. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi. This story was related to me a few years ago. It's a sort of a two-parter, and it goes back a number of years ago. A friend was hanging out with others during hunting season. The others had a friend visiting from California who was a trooper out there. And my friend and this guy hit it off so well that the guy gave him his ball cap that said CHP on it. So then flash forward a few years, someone had to move, another friend had to move out to Vegas for a job and hired my friend and two other friends to help him. They finished. He rented them a car to drive back to Vermont with. Well, the driver was a lot kind of ADD and left at all hours of the morning and took a wrong turn out of Vegas, and they ended up going into California. And they had crossed the line, and they're trying to convince the driver that, indeed, they're in California. And finally, hey, there's a trooper, a California Highway Patrolman on the side. So they pulled over to convince the guy that they were really in California and headed the wrong way. And during the conversation, my friend and this patrolman looked at each other, and my friend happened to be wearing that CHP ball cap. And lo and behold, it was the same guy.
Wow. That's pretty cool, Jim. And, you know, people who maybe are of a certain era will remember the show Chips. And anybody who lived in California knows CHP, California Highway Patrol. What a cool story. Thanks for that, Jim.
Thank you. That is a very nice story.
We have another Jim. What are the odds, Professor Mazur? We have another Jim calling in from Colchester. Let's go right to him. Hi, Jim.
The How odds are pretty good, by the way.
Yes, that's true.
Mine happened in Baffin Island. And hello?
Hi, yeah, we're listening.
Here. Okay. We were hiking up in Baffin Island. The first time we made it up to the glaciers, and we're there, and there was a couple of people across the way from us. We couldn't go over there. And we asked them where they were from. They were from Vermont, and they were circumnavigating the globe by going above the Arctic Circle. A couple of years later, we go back to Baffin Island, and after our tour, we go back to this little Inuit village, Pangerton. And while I was away, a school teacher came up, and he offered to let us go to the high school or the school and get so we could take showers. I'm walking into the schoolhouse, and the guy taps me on the shoulder, and he goes, "Oh, hi, Jim. I haven't seen you in a while." It turns out that he was a rugby player from McGill that I used to play rugby against.
Huh. Jim, how cool. What a coincidence. Thank you for sharing
terrific.
That.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. We are talking today about coincidence and what mathematics tells us about the probability and possibility of strange things happening. We have more of your stories coming up. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And more with Joseph Mazur, author of Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence, including how do we know what the odds are? That seems to be the tagline for so many stories. What are the odds? Well, how do we know? We'll talk about that coming up. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're talking today with Joseph Mazur, author of Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence. And we're hearing many of your stories of coincidence. You can share yours on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or at vpr.net, or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. Sue emailed to say, I live in Vermont, but was in a restaurant in Lima, Peru, when someone approached me and called my name. I hadn't met her, but someone I had known was in Peru and gave them a brief description of me, as she too was headed for Peru. Or someone had known I was in Peru and told this other woman. Sue goes on, we were both there to adopt baby girls. Then, years later, the girls became lab partners in their high school science class. When I heard about my daughter's lab partner and put it all together, I find this amazing. Two very much entwined coincidences. You wanted to comment on that?
Yes, I do. First, these meeting people in strange places, that is a category of coincidences that is the most likely to happen, actually. And the way my book is structured is that I have essentially 10 stories in the book. And these stories are very, very well vetted. They're accurate and they're true.
Although you do talk about, not in the 10 stories, but at the beginning, you talk about your vacuum cleaner incident, and I have no way of verifying that. So I just
That's not one of the 10 stories.
No, that's true.
I just tell it in the introduction, I believe. But that's not one of the classification
that's right.
stories. So the 10 stories are classifying 10 categories of coincidences, and each of those is a representative of the category that it represents. But I want to be careful. I want people to understand that it's impossible to analyze these stories so sharply as to assign some precise odds. Besides, I wouldn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
In my book, I categorize stories, the 10 stories, such as meetings in strange places, winning the lottery. Events that come together in precise timings, events that come together in imprecise timings, dreams that come true, that sort of thing.
Right. You include Abraham Lincoln's
yes,
dreams that
yes.
were these sort of premonitions of mm-hmm. big, important events to come that
That's
something
right.
always
his,
happened.
His own assassination
yeah.
included. Then I tell one story from each category as a representative, and I analyze each story and come up with representative odds for each. But let's not take those odds as some serious number that is exact. The point for me is to show that coincidences are rare, but that they fall into hierarchies of surprise. So one story might have odds close to that of four of a kind in poker, and another close to that of a royal flush. But that's the idea. In other words, when you have some odds, in other words, I'm trying to show that these stories do have odds that are non-zero. Mm. They're not so freakily close to zero that they won't occur. In other words, and there is a kind of a philosophical law in mathematics called the law of truly large numbers. And what it essentially says is that if something has a probability that is not zero, then it's bound to happen sometime. You know, it's kind of like the monkey problem. That I don't know whether people know the monkey problem, mm-hmm.
If you gave them all typewriters?
Yeah. If you go back to 1913, the mathematician Emil Borel, he decided to tackle an age-old question about randomness. And could totally random events amount to something meaningful? And the more popular rendition of the question soon became, could a monkey randomly hitting the keys of a keyboard type out a Shakespeare sonnet? And the answer is yes. And in mathematics, if that answer is yes, then the monkey could, in theory, type out all the books in the Library of Congress, the largest library in the world. I compute the odds of the monkey typing just the first word of shall,
mm-hmm.
as in shall I compare thee to a summer's day? And it's about 8 million to 1, right? Mm-hmm. The poor monkey needs help, though. So you put 8 million monkeys together and maybe it it will happen faster.
Well, but, right. And then you talk about how many humans there are. And certainly, you know, things are going to happen to people. But when you must get pushback from people who say, well, sure, I understand. There's a possibility out there of somebody running into somebody else. But me running into this person,
that's exactly
here?
It. And that's exactly it. You know, the odds of somebody running into somebody else is very, very high.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's likely they're right at this as we speak now. There are people bumping into each other all the time, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Joan Ginther, the woman who won the lottery four times, if I say, gee, Joan Ginther, is she the one who won the lottery four times, the odds of that is septillion to one, you know? It's incredible odds. If I say it's Joan Ginther ahead of time, but I'm saying it in retrospect.
Right.
If I say somebody will win, somebody in this country or in this world will win the lottery four times, the odds are pretty good.
Right.
I'm sure it happens very often.
Yeah, that's the amazing part. And you know, do you think it diminishes the magic in any way to say, well, I mean, you just look at how many people there are in the world and you're going to run into somebody? Or can we still have the magic about these coincidences?
The magic is in the beauty of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what it really amounts to. It's the beauty of it, and it's also the meaningfulness of it.
Hmm.
Because many of these stories are very meaningful. They lead to other things because, you know, there are romances that are there are romances that happen because of synchronicity. There are romances that happen all the time because of just simple coincidences.
Mm-hmm. Let me get a couple more in here. Susan in South Woodbury says, some years ago I was taking my three children to visit Sturbridge Village, going down Route 91 through Massachusetts. We pulled off at a scenic overlook and got out of the car. Standing next to the car, next to our car, we found my brother Joel, who lives in Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
He and my nephew were on a college tour. We looked at each other and laughed and had a short conversation, then went on to our respective planned stops. I've been shaking my head over that coincidence ever since. It didn't seem real. And Susan took pains to point out neither of them had known the other was on this trip. And let's get another one in here.
Can I comment on that?
Of course, yeah.
For just a minute. It's also, it happens that you could have missed your brother. In other words, the surprise was in meeting your brother, but what if you had just missed him just by
mm-hmm.
10 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
This happens all the time, too. We just don't notice the misses.
Well, yeah, we don't know about them.
We don't know about them.
Yeah. Huh. Let's go to Chris calling in from Hinesburg. Hi, Chris. Go right ahead.
Hi there. I had a strange, this is another person coincidence. I lived in Germany as a child, and in second grade, there was some celebration, and I can't quite recall what it was, but the second graders had to choose a king and queen of the second grade. So I was chosen queen. This little boy was chosen king. I have a picture of us with little silly cardboard crowns on.
Uh-huh.
Fast forward 50 years, and I was in the old Ben Franklin in South Burlington, which I rarely went into to get something, and I had this funny feeling someone was following me. It was creepy. So I kind of kept looking over my shoulder, and the feeling just increased. And finally, I came around one corner, and this man is standing there, and he looks right at me, and he says, "Christy?" And I said, "David?" And this was the king from second grade in Germany, who now lived in California, had been visiting a friend in New York and decided to take a drive to Vermont.
Wow. And I'm impressed that you two were able, as adults, to recognize the second grader in each of you. What a cool story, Chris. Thanks. Let's go to Edward in Montreal. Hi, Edward. You're on.
Hi. Many of these uncanny coincidences are seem to be as probabilistic and given a prosaic explanation. But I know that there are conceptions in physics that posit that this reality may be embedded in like a higher dimensional system. So when I'm inclined to favor the view that we don't exactly know what's going on. We're not necessarily, events don't necessarily follow cause and effect, linear progression. Like we could be embedded in a in a structure that we don't fully understand, and thus these uncanny coincidences occur because we're expecting linear cause and effect, whereas the situation we're in is more complicated than that. Do you care to comment?
Yes, I would comment. Yes, this is what Jung's synchronicity is all about. I mean, he really felt, and he had talked. He talked to a physicist about this as well, that in fact that there's something else out there, kind of like a gravity question or radio wave question. He felt that there was something else out there that gave us these things, but also that it somehow the mind itself has imbibed all of this, so that we know about these things because some people pay more attention to them, because they are more in tune to whatever is out there. I mean, if you read Jung's synchronicity books, this is what he is addressing, exactly what you're talking about. I think I wouldn't have believed that before I started research on this book, but I'm inclined to agree with you and agree that there is something else out there that is not simply a question of odds or chance that we can actually pin down.
What about this question from Silas, who asks, what's the relationship between the math of random and the math of chaos, if any? Can random exist in a state of absolute order, or is a degree of chaos required?
A degree of chaos is required, especially in the physical world. There's no such thing as total mathematically theoretical randomness in the physical world. I mean, you know, when you're looking at those little ping pong balls falling down the machine that's going to determine the number of a lottery. You know, that's pretty nicely random, but it's not really random. You know, it's not completely random. There's nothing in this world that's really random. That coin that's being tossed at the beginning of a Super Bowl, that's not a random thing. That's not a random event. In fact, one could simply flip a coin and have it come out the way that one wants, because most coin flips are not really spinning coins. They're just precessing coins, where the top is really just making you believe that it's turning around, but it's not really, and it's falling down on the face that it began with. So that's one thing about coin tossing. But the other is that if you look at randomness itself, there really is no such thing. If you can make a random machine to determine the odds of what the number is going to be in the lottery pick, that would be a colossal thing. But it doesn't exist.
Okay, what about this? We also got a note from VPR classical host Kari Anderson, who says, when my dad was teaching statistics, one of his favorite games was the birthday paradox. In a room of 23 people, there's a 50-50 chance that two will have the same birthday. And you write about this in the book, too. Could you explain that?
Yes. There again, we're not saying which two people in that room are going to have the same birthday. We're saying there are two people in a group of 23 people. The odds are better than even that they will have the same birthday. That's what we're saying. We're not defining the two people, just as we weren't defining who Joan Ginther was who won the lottery four times.
So, Joseph Mazur, after publishing this book, The Math and Myth of Coincidence, and now being the repository for so many other people's stories.
It's quite a job.
Well, are you sick of them? I mean, do you get bored?
No, not at all.
But so many of these stories, it's like, listen to this. This is amazing. And if you weren't one experiencing it, it's not that amazing.
Well, that's true. It's more amazing to the person experiencing it. But they are wonderful stories. And every day I hear a new one that, you know, I wish I had infinite time to write this book because I would include many more. They're just unbelievable stories. I mean, there's no time to talk about some of the really spectacular ones on the air, but they really are spectacular, and I'm hearing about them every day.
Well, I appreciate you being here, helping us listen to our wonderful listener stories and sharing a little bit about what you know. I want to recommend The Math and the Myth of Coincidence, Fluke, Joseph Mazur's book. He does have 10 pretty great stories in the book, and then, you know, goes into analyzing the odds or how you sort of calculate the probability and possibility of these things happening. Professor Mazur, thank you so much for being on the program again.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Coming up, Health Commissioner Dr. Harry Chen joins us not to talk about coincidence, but to talk about steps being taken to curb overprescription of opioid medication. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In his State of the State address back in January, Governor Peter Shumlin told the legislature he wanted to go further to try to curb opiate addiction in Vermont. He proposed limiting the number of pain pills of this type that a doctor could prescribe after minor medical procedures to 10. The legislature has been tackling this issue, and a bill addressing opiate prescriptions has passed the Senate and is being discussed just this week in the House Committee on Human Services. Joining us now to talk about that and how to address prescribing at the national level is Vermont's Health Commissioner, Dr. Harry Chen. Dr. Chen, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Jane. It's great to be here. Thank you.
I want to start on the national side, and then we'll come back to Vermont. You're part of a group of officials from several states that's been petitioning the federal government to make some changes, and you hope these changes might be one step in curbing overprescribing. So let's talk a little bit about the petition you signed asking for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to change some wording on a survey. Can you explain?
Yes, Jane. And I think the important thing to realize is that when your doctor sits down with you and writes you a prescription for pain pills, or when he or she gives you some medications in the hospital, it's not in a vacuum. And so it really is surrounded by an environment and a cultural context. And one of the important contexts is really how hospitals are reimbursed. And the biggest insurer in our country is Medicare. And one of the things Medicare does is it defines quality and reimburses hospitals based on whether they think they're achieving quality or not. And one of those quality metrics is how aggressively your hospital treats pain. And so what we're trying to do is have CMS reconsider those questions and whether they're appropriate given where we find ourselves in terms of overdose deaths and understanding the relationship between overprescribing as a cause, a root cause of our current overdose and addiction crisis.
Because you think that perhaps changing this questionnaire and either removing or changing the question that asks patients about pain management and then tying that to these reimbursement rates, if that question was off or changed, doctors might feel a little bit less pressure to overprescribe pain relief?
Well, I think it's pressure to aggressively provide pain relief. And in the end, oftentimes it ends up being overprescription or unwarranted. And I think what happens is it's not just the doctor. Mm-hmm. So the hospitals, each hospital has a quality improvement team that tries to improve quality. And one of the ways is to look at how you're being measured. And if you're being measured by CMS to ensure that, you know, during your hospital stay, how often did the hospital do everything they could to help you with your pain, then you're going to change your behavior based on that. The nurses are going to ask you more often how your pain is. The nurses are going to be more likely to call the doctor asking for more pain medicine. And it can kind of go, as you can see, it goes down the line.
I can imagine some people saying, whoa, are you saying that we shouldn't be worried about my pain level? Because if I'm in the hospital, I certainly want to have my pain managed.
Well, you're absolutely right. I think that treating, you know, physicians and hospital and healthcare providers are really duty bound to treat pain and treat pain adequately.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that we need to, as a society, have a little discussion about, are we talking about getting rid of all pain, or are we really talking about keeping people comfortable and allowing them to function in their lives if it's a chronic person with chronic pain versus to exist without pain? And realistically, opioids do not work by getting rid of pain. The pain's still there, but as I was taught in medical school, you just care a lot less about it.
Hmm. What else would you like to see on the national level?
Well, I think the the other thing that's important is to understand how we measure satisfaction in hospitals. For example, the Joint Commission on Hospitals in 2001 created pain as the fifth vital sign. And so in hospitals, currently we measure individuals' pain, and we more aggressively than I think we should actually try to treat that, to actually get that to a lower level. As I said, in the press release, in my experience in hospitals, in an emergency department, you actually would have to wake people up to ask them how bad their pain was.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're sleeping, to me, you're comfortable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that should really be the measure rather than getting your pain down to one. I think additionally, we had to look at there's an organization that many hospitals use for satisfaction surveys called Press Ganey. And there are other outfits that do the same thing. And we need to look carefully at the questions on them about how aggressively your providers and the hospital is treating your pain. And perhaps it should be more nuanced about, again, as I said, being comfortable, able to get by with your requirements of daily living.
Let's get down to the state level. There's a bill that has now passed the Senate, and it's being debated in committee in the House now, that would, among other things, require the health commissioner, currently you, to create some new rules. And here's a line from the bill as it was passed by the Senate. It says, "The rules may include numeric and temporal limitations on the number of pills prescribed, including a maximum number of pills to be prescribed following minor medical procedures." So, in other words, it's up to you and your department, with input from a wide array of interested parties, to think about the possibility of maybe setting limitations, maybe a number of pills on how much can be prescribed following these minor medical procedures, and looking at guidelines for major medical procedures. How would you go about doing that?
Well, I think it's important to note that in the past couple of weeks, CDC has released a guideline for treatment of chronic pain. And in that, they actually briefly address acute pain, which is what we're talking about, meaning if you have a procedure or you fall and injure yourself. And they're really talking about generally people will require at most 3 days of therapy. And a maximum should be 7 days. So right there, a national organization has kind of laid down some framework where we can start. But I think the way I would approach it is I've had calls from physicians worried about government prescribing how they should practice medicine. And I absolutely understand that, and it's clear, and don't disagree with that. But I think at the same vein, they're telling me that if you're getting a hip done and you ask five different doctors how many days worth of pain medicines they give, you might get five different answers. And there's no science about what's the right answer, but it's trying to get a collaboration with the prescribers to agree to, well, what's a reasonable amount that we can all agree to that somebody should come back from the hospital after a hip replacement. And to try to move that needle downward. So we're prescribing less opiates in Vermont and less of them are hanging out in the drug cabinets.
And you do think it would be reasonable at some point to set a pill limit, a number limit or an amount limit of some sort?
Generally, it would be a number of days of mm-hmm. therapy. Okay, so you can expect, how long do you expect this pain? People have people have been doing this a long time, know how long probably your pain is going to last. And if it actually lasts longer than that, then that actually may be a good reason to have some follow-up or a follow-up phone call, at which time, if you need more medication, it could be provided.
This bill does other things as well. And again, it's passed the Senate, but still is going through the House, so it could change. But right now it addresses how often prescribing providers should be checking patient histories on the Vermont prescription monitoring system when prescribing opioids. It would require the establishment of a statewide prescription drug disposal program. It would encourage an increase in people who can prescribe buprenorphine as a treatment for opioid addiction, set some guidelines for more continuing education for physicians. It also looks at acupuncture as a treatment method, a few other things, including educating veterinarians. Do you think it's likely to pass? Is this going to happen this year, Dr. Chen?
Well, I'm hopeful that it will. I know that both at the state level and at the national level, there's a lot of attention being paid to the opiate crisis, and I think it will pass. I think, and I know that the governor is It's a high priority of his. I know that the House and the Senate, both in terms of the legislative committees, are oriented to getting something done.
Dr. Harry Chan is Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Health. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
Energy issues are big in Vermont, and one thorny sliver of the debate over energy is who should have a say in where energy projects like wind and solar are located. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll talk with two lawmakers who've been working on legislation that takes on that question. You can send your comments on siting to vermontedition@vpr.net and join the discussion tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance today from Michelle Owens. Liam Connors directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.